Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Sarah Tyson, and Malcolm Keating. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books in a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Neil Levy, professor of philosophy at Macquarie University and research fellow at the Oxford Uehiro Center for Practical Ethics. His new book, Bad Beliefs, Why They Happen to Good People, is just out from Oxford University Press and is accessible freely online. Misinformation, disinformation, fake news, alternative facts. We are awash in a vast sea of epistemically questionable, not to mention false, testimony. How can we discern what is epistemically good to believe from what is not? And why are so many of us apparently vulnerable to believing what is epistemically bad? In his new book, Levy argues that we are, in fact, acting rationally in accordance with how we have evolved to defer to our peers and authorities in our social networks. Levy argues that bad beliefs, which are beliefs that are unresponsive to reliable evidence, are more likely in epistemically polluted environments, and that our current epistemic environments are, in fact, epistemically polluted. Overall, the book takes a bold stand against traditional epistemological emphasis on the individual cognitive agent's responsibility for justifying their beliefs. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Neil Levy. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Thanks, Carrie. Thanks for the invitation.
So we're going to be talking about your new book, Bad Beliefs, Why They Happen to Good People. But let's talk about you first for a second. What's your philosophical background? How did you sort of get interested in philosophy and get interested in, the areas that you work in? And, you know, how did this particular book come about?
I don't know how I ended up in philosophy, by accident, I guess. After a false start studying journalism, I enrolled in a degree in English literature. These were the days of high theory, and I gravitated towards theory, which was basically continental philosophy. Ended up doing a PhD on continental philosophy, but classified as a cultural studies degree or literary theory degree. Then I couldn't get a job, unsurprisingly, and did a second PhD, this time in philosophy on the metaphysics of free will. At some point, I've been doing applied ethics most of my career, largely because for entirely practical reasons, that's where the jobs were. At some point, I wanted to become empirical in applied ethics, doing applied ethics in a way that was informed by science, particularly psychological science. So I became more and more interested in how moral cognition works, and that led to cognition more generally. So I guess by drift is the answer.
And this book, I know you've done some very interesting, you know, empirical actually work as well as theoretical work in broadly speaking of social epistemology.
That's right. So in Australia, I sort of have a lab with a postdoc who's a psychologist, and we do work on beliefs and rationality in the kind of work that philosophers like to draw on, as well as more straightforward psychological work. But I also like to bracket all of that and do straight philosophy as well. I think I'm a pluralist in philosophy, and I think we need lots of different approaches.
Good. Okay. So bad beliefs, what are they? Let's start with the basic question.
Nothing very precise, and that's the answer to every question you're going to ask. very precise. So by bad beliefs, I'm trying to pick out beliefs that are that conflict with what we take the evidence to show. So for many subjects, there are no bad beliefs in that there's no strong evidence or there's no highly reliable evidence. On some topics, there's evidence that's produced by an epistemic community, which we have good reason to think is a well-structured epistemic community, where that evidence strongly supports one conclusion or a very narrow range of conclusions. So bad belief is a belief that conflicts with those conclusions. So paradigm bad beliefs are climate change skepticism, anti-vax beliefs, beliefs about electoral systems, for example. The big steal is a bad belief. There's a belief that is not supported by credible evidence, and yet apparently people hold this belief.
So is it the fact, what makes it bad, that there's evidence for the opposite and they're believing a false belief? Or, I mean, you also have a bit of a discussion about what makes something a belief in terms of like what we do as well as what we think, right? And so bad beliefs are genuine beliefs on your view. You know, they're just like false beliefs, right?
Yes. When I started this book, which was pre-pandemic, it's a pandemic book, I was going to define belief quite precisely. I was particularly interested in that debate. I ended up with a book in which I don't define anything very precisely, including belief. But it is important for me that a belief is a representational state that drives behavior. I do think there's a lot of endorsements out there, put it neutrally, that is claims that people endorse, which don't drive behavior beyond endorsement or drive a very narrow range of behavior. And there's an open question about whether those are genuine beliefs, but also whether we should care all that much or what reasons we have for caring that people endorse things which they then don't go on to act on. With climate change skepticism, people do act on it. They resist legislation that would address it. Plays a role in their choice of political candidates and so on. So I think that's beliefy enough for us to be really concerned about.
Okay.
Anti-vax beliefs is probably even a better example, because you can worry about all kinds of expressive behavior. But here's a belief that's powerful enough that people are saying, I'm not going to allow my child to get vaccinated. That looks like a factual belief to me.
Right. Good. Okay. So one of the things, again, that you say in the very beginning, actually, of the book is that you started to write a very different book than the one that we are actually discussing, the one that actually you did end up writing. So it might be helpful to say how you had planned to write about bad belief, you know, some explanation of why people hold them, as a kind of prelude to the positive account that that you actually ended up defending in the book.
Sure. So the book I thought I was going to write was a book about deficits and dispositions. The question was, how do people who believe badly differ from those who believe well in how they think, how they process evidence? And the hypothesis, if you want to put it that way, was that they're going to be more susceptible to confirmation bias, they're going to be less open-minded, they're going to be less epistemically humble, and these factors were going to be powerful influences on belief formation. Problem is, I just don't think it's true. Now, this may be a bad belief of mine. It's an open question in psychology right now to what extent this is true. I don't think it's a bad belief, but it's a debated question in psychology. There are a number of respectable and respected psychologists who think that the story I just sketched is in fact the right story. But, you know, psychology is going through a replication crisis, and I think a lot of the evidence for that is not so much unreplicable as cherry-picked. It uses a narrow range of questions, a narrow range of topics. It's framed inadvertently to get the conclusion it generates, that bad believers are disposed towards bad belief. I don't think that's a major part of the story, although I do think it's part of the story.
Okay. So I suppose that if there's an overarching message of the book, it's that, you know, bad believers aren't, you know, as you sort of just mentioned, aren't really doing anything differently or irrational or more buffeted by, you know, various cognitive biases than good believers. And that's because individual cognition is just, you know, not as determinative of our beliefs as we, you know, perhaps we philosophers, you know, epistemologists tend to think. Would you say that that's, you know, sort of where you ended up? And then, of course, from that comes the main message of the book, I suppose, which is it's the contexts, the environments in which we're embedded that determine whether you end up in the bad believing camp or the good believing camp.
Yeah. Right? So, you know, as I mentioned, I started in continental philosophy, and in some ways the picture is not all that far from somebody like Foucault. Bad beliefs is a sociological state. It's not a state of a bad belief is not picked out by a belief that's false, but by a sociological status. That is, it conflicts with the findings of epistemic communities, well-structured epistemic communities. That's sociological. The explanation of why people hold bad beliefs is also largely sociological. It's to do with trust networks. It's true that bad believers aren't typically stellar epistemic agents who are engaged in responsible updating of beliefs in the light of evidence carefully gathered. But almost nobody is, and nor should we expect them to be. Bad believers come to their beliefs for the same reasons as good believers, via testimony. Testimony is a perfectly fine, to use a technical term, a perfectly legitimate way of acquiring beliefs. It's a way in which we can acquire beliefs that have the kind of epistemic status we want our beliefs to have. The difference between bad and good believers is, who do you trust as a source of testimony?
Okay. Can you say a bit more about that? I mean, we're all embedded in similar sorts of environments. I mean, people, you know, one of the striking, I suppose, you know, aspects of, you know, climate change and denial or vaccine or any of the standard paradigm cases of bad belief is, you know, these sorts of beliefs have, you know, split families, for example. You know, it's not like people on the other side of the world have, you know, acquired certain beliefs and those of us over here, but, you know, it's like the person that we see every day at the dining table or, you know, at breakfast or that we hang out with. So how is it that, like, some of those people at the very same, you know, table will end up, you know, QAnon or, you know, climate denial, and you know, their partner, like right across the table, is like, that's not a good belief.
So in the empirical literature, one of the strongest predictors of accepting conspiracy theories is trust in mainstream media. If you have low trust in mainstream media and you're looking for other sources, that's relatively likely to push you in conspiratorial directions. I do think trust is the key ingredient here. So I don't know quite the right metaphor, but each of us has an epistemic outlook, something like that, constituted by a set of priors, in Bayesian terms, a set of prior beliefs, which are weighted in various ways, and also a set of priors not only in what we take to be the case, but also what we take to be, or who we take to be, reliable sources of evidence and unreliable sources of evidence. And then we update, given those background priors, what we take to be the case antecedently, which of course we weigh relatively heavily, so that evidence that conflicts with it has to pass a higher threshold for us to update in its light. And discounting evidence when it comes from somebody we see as unreliable. And then we know quite a lot about what makes people reliable informants. That is, what factors we actually weigh as markers of reliability. A lot of it is straightforward. We weigh consensus heavily. We weigh competence heavily. If somebody has a record of getting things wrong by our lights, then we discount the testimony. But we also take their values into account very heavily, and that's rational. Because if you don't share my values, you're telling me something. I may rightly wonder whether you have my interests at heart in telling me this, whether you're trying to deceive me, whether you're trying to take advantage of me, or whether you just don't care whether I end up with true beliefs. And these relations of trust, I think, predict how we process evidence. And given perfectly normal Bayesian update, you can get polarization. You can get people forming beliefs in opposite directions on the same set of inputs. I don't show that. I don't have the formal skills, but Kevin Dorst does show that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you've in a way you've kind of backed into this, what you call in the book, this idea of, you know, outsourcing belief, you know, which involves, you know, again, networks of trust, relying on other people. And you argue that this outsourcing, you know, is both, you know, much more fundamental to, you know, to what we come to believe than, you know, your standard individualistic epistemology, right? So that's a very, you know, sort of key social epistemic, you know, premise of your argument. Can you say a bit about why this, you know, how this outsourcing works and why it is, you know, rational for us to do it?
Sure. So here I'm quite strongly influenced by the literature in cultural evolution, a particular set of literature in cultural evolution, the so-called West Coast school, more than the Parisians. The cultural evolution literature, you could look at it as a sort of anthropological literature. It's trying to explain the success of indigenous knowledge. And indigenous knowledge of how to cope in harsh environments can be extremely sophisticated and extremely successful. It's got to be successful because there they are, coping in harsh environments, not just coping, but flourishing. Harsh environments from the Australian outback through to the Arctic tundra. And we know these are really harsh environments because there are a number of, you know, well-equipped expeditions into this environment, you know, financed by the richest empire the world had ever seen at that point, the British Empire, ended in disaster. So Franklin's expedition to the Canadian North, I believe everybody perished, but they actually perished in a area that the local Inuit called Fat Island because it was so rich in resources. They were simply unable to create the techniques of surviving in that winter for themselves. They had the same big brains as the Inuits. They had all this science, but they were unable to create those techniques. Food detoxification methods are great examples. So corn leads to a disease called pellagra, corn consumption. It took until the 1930s for, now I'm going to sound like a New Age kook, Western science to identify what was causing pellagra. It turns out to be niacin deficiency. But the indigenous people who relied on corn didn't get pellagra. It was almost unknown. And that's because they cooked corn with an alkali, which releases the niacin that's chemically bound in the corn. Obviously, they had no concept of niacin or alkali, but they'd hit upon a way of doing, a way of going on that enabled them to flourish and to rely on this this staple food. And almost certainly, they developed this through genuine evolutionary processes, which can work much more rapidly when it's cultural evolution than biological evolution. They didn't have explicit knowledge about how to do this, but they knew you had to do it, and they were able to pass on this knowledge. We are agents who are adapted to acquire knowledge in this kind of way because that's the kind of animal we are. The kind of knowledge we need to flourish in a local environment can't be genetically encoded because it varies from environment to environment. Detoxification for cassava is completely different to detoxification for corn, which is completely different from detoxification for the nardoo plant in the Australian outback, all of these staple foods need to be detoxified, and you need to detoxify them in completely different ways. By cooking with alkali in one case, by washing and storing and washing again in another case, by grinding the seeds and roasting the seed pods in the third case. These are completely different techniques. You've got to acquire them from your group. You can't invent them for yourselves. So we have these dispositions to acquire knowledge vertically and horizontally. That is from our peers as children, but from our elders as well. Particularly respected elders. So we have prestige biases, we have conformity biases. These are ways of acquiring local know-how, which we absolutely need. We're disposed to do it. We will do it whether we are aware of doing it or not. And all going well, there are ways of acquiring knowledge.
Okay, so... So what a, you know, you argue that it's that we do in fact, often, you know, outsource, you know, not just like we outsource, you know, I'm going to rely on trust this particular person to give me testimony if they, you know, share my values and belong to my community and so forth. But you also have this idea that, you know, of second order evidence where we also outsource the very decision of like, who should I rely on? So can you explain how that works?
I think of this as, you know, networks of trust. So I do read some of the climate change literature myself, but I'm very limited in how much I can absorb, how much I can understand, because I'm not a climate scientist and I don't have either the special background in climate science or the mathematical sophistication that I need to make sense of it. But I have strong opinions, and I take it I have justified opinions. I have justified opinions because I discount and weigh work on climate science in a way that's sensitive to those people I take to be the people to defer to. Who are they? Well, they're people who have certain markers of reliability. They possess PhDs, they in the relevant area, of course. They possess track records of publication in the relevant areas. They represent a consensus. So I think that consensus statements by scientific organizations are very powerful here. There's work that then conflicts with that consensus, I regard, you know, as unlikely to be reliable, and work that coheres with it, I weigh more heavily. When I watch the news, I'm sensitive to these cues in an indirect way. I hope that the news organizations are themselves keyed in to networks which trace back to reliable sources. As we know, not all networks are the right networks or the right informants. And we also know that even the best ones get it wrong and have policies that enforce a balance when no balance should be enforced, for example. But on many topics, we are apt to, and I think justified in relying on what we see on mainstream news sources, because we take those mainstream news sources to be sensitive to testimony, which is in turn sensitive to testimony, which is in turn sensitive to testimony, which is reflecting the scientific consensus. So I do take it to be mediated. There's lots of information loss. There's lots of room for it to go wrong. But so long as the testimonial networks are sufficiently thick and there are, you know, multiple sources and corrections going on, I think the whole network can be relied on. In any case, it is relied on. So we better try to make these networks as reliable as possible, because even the people who say, I do my own research, actually rely on their own networks in just the same sort of way. They're just different networks.
Mm-hmm. So let me, so you've been talking about, you know, what is just it that we're justified in relying on these networks, you know, these indicators of consensus. And a moment ago, you're also talking about that we are adapted, you know, we're the kind of creature that acquires knowledge, you know, through, you know, cultural transmission in various ways. So I just wanted to clarify what you mean when you say it's rational for, you know, for us to, you know, have, you know, hold bad beliefs. Do you mean it's rational because we are adapted to acquiring beliefs from, you know, from our peers and our elders? Or do you mean it's rational because it's being responsive to the evidence? Normally, the idea of being adapted to something is distinguished, I should say, from, you know, what we ought to do, you know, the way we do it, the way we've, you know, evolved, versus some sort of normative sense of rationality. Can you explain how you see that distinction, if you think there is a distinction there?
I accept that distinction. So I map this onto sort of Gigerenzo versus, say, Kahneman and Tversky to use reference points from the psychological literature. So Kahneman and Tversky famously claim that cognition is irrational because, or elements, important elements of cognition are irrational because we rely on heuristics and biases, and these heuristics and biases leave us leaving evidence on the table, or responding to the way evidence is framed in a way that doesn't reflect its actual force, and so on. So they say it's irrational, and it's the normative sense of irrationality that you just distinguished that they have in mind. And Gigerenzo comes along and says, well, be that as it may, people are rational because doing these things, there's no accident that we are subject to these heuristics and biases. Because, you know, God made us and God had a sense of humor. It's because evolution made us, and evolution, although it's not a maximizing process, of course, doesn't, unlikely to result in systematic dispositions that don't work. And these ones do work. The heuristics and biases are, in fact, adapted to the environment, and they're adapted to the environment in an epistemic sense. They enable us to achieve our epistemic goals. So, and that's an ecological sense of rationality. And quite a few people who defend the rationality of human cognition do so on those grounds. I'm agnostic on the Gigerenzo, Kahneman, and Tversky debate. That is to say, I don't know whether the best account of the evolution of heuristics and biases is one on which they are well adapted to ancestral environments. My claim is more fundamental, which is that a great deal of the evidence, not all of it, but a great deal of the evidence for the heuristics and biases is misunderstanding what's going on. And it's misunderstanding by what's going on by looking at the first order evidence only. It's the shared mistake of Gigerenza and Kahneman and Tversky. So framing effects is a nice example. Framing effects work by presenting agents with scenarios which differ only in how the information is framed. So the same set of numbers is framed either in a loss frame, 400 people will die out of 600, or a gain frame, 200 will be saved out of 600. For example, in Kahneman and Tversky's famous original experiment. And Kahneman and Tversky say, well, it'd be irrational for you to change your preferences over options, whether to choose A and or B versus alternatives, just on the basis of the framing, because all the first order facts are held fixed across frames. And I say, yes, all the first order facts are held fixed, but that doesn't mean it's irrational to change your preference on the basis of framing. It depends how framing works. Framing, I suggest, is testimony. And it's perfectly rational to change your preferences over first order fixed facts depending on what testimony you're given. So if somebody comes along and says, which of these options is better, A or B? You know a lot about A or B. So I choose A or B, and they say B, and I say, okay, I'll choose B. If anyone says to me, wow, you're highly irrational, because if Carrie had said A, you would have chosen A. But all the, you know, A and B aren't changed by Carrie's recommendations. They're the same across both the actual case and the counterfactual. You know, I'm going to say, well, hang on. That's how recommendations work. Recommendations don't change the first order facts. They change my preferences in a second order way. Carrie says this option is better than that one. I don't take Carrie's preferences to change the option. I take them to be a guide to which is more choice-worthy. That's how framing works. And there's experimental evidence that is how framing works, that people take the gain frame to be used to recommend an option, and it is used to recommend an option. People do use a gain frame when they think more highly of an option. It's communicative. There's nothing irrational about responding to communications. And I think we can generalize that. A default effects, where people are more likely to choose an option that's a default, I think that's an implicit recommendation. Order effects, where people have preferences for items listed earlier, implicit recommendation. Salience effects, implicit recommendations. There's nothing irrational normatively about responding to this. It's responding to implicit testimony. And it's perfectly rational to respond to testimony.
Okay. Well, that was helpful. Because I would have, you know, sort of pegged you on the Gigerenzer side of that debate, which would not be precisely correct then. So we talk about implicit recommendations, and this is where you get into, you know, talking about nudges, right? Which I want to get to, but first I think it might be helpful to talk about what you call, you know, polluted environments or epistemically polluted environments, because, you know, the upshot is that, you know, when, I mean, the subtitle of the book is Why Bad Beliefs Happen to Good People. And the idea is, you know, these, you know, people, good people, that we are justified, we are rational in obtaining the you know, the beliefs that we have. I mean, this is sort of, it's been rational. It's helped us survive to acquire beliefs the way we do, you know, using others and depending on them to, you know, provide us with good information. And you argue that the problem is not that the people who are believing the bad things are, you know, again, somehow like not operating in some normatively good way, but that they're in an epistemically polluted environment in some way. So, and moreover, that, you know, this is the kind of environment we're in. And most of us don't have the ability to navigate in this polluted environment. So can you explain how you define an epistemically polluted environment, why you think we're in one, or at least some of us, and why we can't, you know, sort of make our way through this kind of environment, why it ends up messing us up?
Sure. So go back to an earlier point in the conversation. You pointed out that people in very similar circumstances, you know, across the dinner table from each other, can end up going in different directions. And that's important. It's important to emphasize that how much we share any value of we, you, like, say, Americans, to like most of the research is done in the US, so you can use Americans as an example. Why do two middle class people diverge on, say, climate change, given similar sorts of social setting, background, education, and so forth? Interestingly, Republicans who know more about climate science are more likely to be climate skeptics than those who know less. I think, given how much we share, it would be very surprising if people ended up with bad beliefs. If there was nothing they could point to in what looks like science to support the bad beliefs, the status of science is such that very few people are really sincerely prepared to say, well, my beliefs conflict with science, but so much the worse for science. It's because apparent science, and for that matter, genuine science, is polluted that it's possible to end up with bad beliefs. There's just enough science out there, apparent science and real science, to support climate change skepticism, for example. By which I mean there are enough people with genuine PhDs, for example, from reputable institutions and with genuine publications, who will come along and say the science isn't reliable. They are pollutants insofar as we live in an epistemic environment in which they are given far more prominence than they deserve. Some of them may be perfectly sincere. I don't want to censor them nor to silence them. The epistemic environment, the environment of cues on which we look to in deciding how to allocate epistemic trust, is polluted when those cues aren't distributed in a way that reflects their actual prevalence in the scientific community, for example. A media that uses false balance, that says, well, if we've got somebody who says climate change is real, we need somebody else who says it's not, gives you an impression there's a scientific debate. Media has moved away from that, as I'm sure you know. But there's still organizations that, like the Wall Street Journal, for example, which in many ways is a reliable publication, or, you know, not far from a reliable publication, but will give space to climate change denial. They ensure that the environment is epistemically polluted, that the cues for belief don't match up with how we ought to believe. And I think that's pervasive.
Well, I mean, is it the media's fault? I mean, let me put it another way. There are always going to be, you know, voices of dissent, you know, within the scientific community, right? And sometimes they turn out to be right. You know, sometimes being dogmatic in that way, you know, does pan out, and you know, very often it doesn't. So I doubt you're recommending that the media should stop, you know, reporting dissenting voices, right? So, yes, false balance has, you know, has come under fire, and you know, there's been media changes in response to that, although perhaps not enough. But you know, to what extent is the media responsible, and you know, in effect, exercising a legitimate need, actually, to report dissenting voices, while acknowledging that, you know, there is this consensus, and to what extent should we just say, well, you know, you're polluting our epistemic environment by giving any space at all to this credentialed climate denier, for example, or this credentialed, you know, vaccine denier. I mean, should they just, like, not provide that? I mean, at what point is providing that information, even if it avoids false balance, at what point does the environment become polluted because of that?
Yeah. So first of all, let me preface that by saying I mentioned the media, but the media is certainly not uniquely responsible for epistemic pollution. All kinds of entities are, including scientists, including reputable scientists doing legitimate science. So I mentioned earlier, science is in the middle of a replication crisis. A lot of philosophers will tell you it's social psychology is in the middle of a replication crisis. That's true, but so are many other fields, including oncology. So it's not a problem with psychology specifically. And the replication crisis is a crisis of epistemic pollutants. It's a crisis of scientists putting aside concern for truth for careerist reasons, and that reflects not just bad behavior on the part of scientists, but also a set of incentives which have been out of whack with insofar as our goal is to produce reliable science. And that should be our goal when it's, you know, oncology. Surely that should be our primary goal. So universities are using the wrong incentive systems. Journals, including the best journals, are using unreliable heuristics, like publishing exciting science rather than replicable science. All kinds of private actors are producing epistemic pollution through predatory journals, for example. So I do think the blame is very widespread. Your question is much more difficult. I'm actually tempted to say that the media shouldn't cover dissenting voices when certain conditions are satisfied, when it's a topic of matters. If you want to have a dissenting voice on particle physics, or for that matter, four-dimensionalism, go for it. When there's a strong consensus in the field, when there's also a consensus that the field, which you might need to look beyond the field to find this out, consensus the field is reasonably well structured and sufficiently diverse, that's important. So, you know, certain voices aren't being systematically excluded on irrelevant grounds. And the consensus is big enough. Then I don't think somebody coming along and reporting and saying, I haven't got any peer-reviewed publications on this, but I think that the MMR vaccine is causes autism. I don't think the media should have been reporting that. Were that the case, it changes when I'm thinking of the Wakefield case. There was a paper in The Lancet, and the media, I think, were perfectly within their rights, perhaps even required to cover it when it appears in a mainstream journal, as well as to then cover the subsequent debate and the retraction. And then once it's retracted and it's run its course within science, I think it would be irresponsible of the media to trot out Wakefield now and say, to have him say, oh, it's still true, even though it's retracted and I was found to have engaged in research fraud and have lost my medical license and so forth. It's true. I think it would be irresponsible of the media under those conditions to give him airtime.
Okay. So a number of different questions, but towards the end of the book, you defend nudging, right? I mean, you've had a couple of published papers on this, nudging in the sense of like Cass Sunstein and, you know, setting up environments, in a way that, that promote in this case, good belief rather than bad belief. So can you sort of tell us your defense of nudging? I mean, one of the complaints about it, of course, comes more or less from an individualistic perspective that it somehow violates our epistemic autonomy in certain ways. Can you say a bit about your defense of nudging, and particularly your idea that nudging is, as you mentioned before, actually a form of implicit recommendation?
Right. So I should preface this by saying I wrote the book before the recent debate over meta-analysis of nudging, which concerns not the replicability, but the effect size. This has been debated recently in the proceedings of the National Academy of Science. It does now seem as though the effect size is a lot smaller than both the people who've been pushing nudges and the people who worry about them have thought, and not doing as much as we thought. I'm not surprised by that, but it does give us a reason to think that the whole thing may be, not the important issue that I probably imply at very least that it is. So nudging is ways of changing the environment of choice, such that people choose better, either choose better in their own interests or choose better as measured by social outcomes. And people have worried about this because they see it as paternalistic and violating people's autonomy. Paternalistic because it violates people's autonomy. It may lead you to make choices that are in your own interests, but rather than giving you reasons for making those choices, it changes the structure of the choice in a way that disposes you to make the choice. And Thaler and Sunstein in their book describe it as working in that way. They say nudges take advantage of our cognitive laziness, the fact that we just go with the flow and don't put any effort into thinking. But I think that mischaracterizes at least the central range of nudges. There are probably nudges that my description doesn't capture, but I think the central range actually work by giving us implicit reasons for choice. Richard Thaler, who won the Nobel Prize for Economics, gives the example of his own work on the fault effects for superannuation or retirement savings. When people sign up to a new job, they may be given an employment contract in which they specify what percentage of their take-home pay, probably their pre-tax pay, I assume. I don't know how the US system works, is to be sequestered into an account, a retirement savings account. And people tend to accept the default. So if the default is 1%, then people accept that. And on the basis of data that people tend to undersave for retirement, undersave quite dramatically for retirement, they tested the intervention that by changing the default to, say, 4% or 6%, you can get people to save more. And their work, both in the laboratory and a little bit outside, shows that people are significantly more likely to choose the higher level if that's the default. So you've prompted people into acting in their own interests. People worry about that because, as they say, having a higher default savings rate isn't a reason to save more. It's just it's a nudge. It's a push that comes, bypassing our reasoning, if you like. It pushes us in the back in the direction of saving more rather than, you know, sitting us down and saying, here's a good reason why you ought to save more. But I don't think that's how it works. I think it is a reason. It's an implicit reason. People make the implicit assumption that the option selected as a default has been selected as a default because it's at least satisfactory. And I suspect here's a thought experiment to demonstrate this. Suppose you were to choose as your default 80%. 80% of your pre-tax wage is going to be put in your retirement account. I bet you people would think, well, something's gone wrong here, and wouldn't go with the default. Rather, they see it as a reasonable amount, and that's why they select it. That's why they are disposed to select it. The smallness of the effect size doesn't surprise me. Only one piece of information, as I see it, among many other pieces of information. If they have good reason to override it, they will. If they don't want to save for retirement, if they have some reason to think that they won't live that long, for example, then they won't accept it. And in the book, I did mention the very small effect sizes with the ballot order effect. The ballot order effect is John Doris's principal example in his behavioral and brain sciences article on how we are influenced in these irrational ways. The ballot order effect is we tend to prefer candidates higher up the ballot to candidates lower down the ballot. And he says, you know, where you're put on the ballot isn't in fact a reason to choose. And that's right. Ballot order might be randomized or drawn by lot, or it might be alphabetical, that doesn't mean that people aren't treating it as a reason, because we do use order to implicate importance. We do it with news services, for example. The most important item is listed first. So they may be responding in a way that reflects what they take to be an implicit recommendation. And the effect sizes are very small. And it's only an effect at all for people who are low information, who have no prior information about the candidates, or no preference between them. Small nudges, small effect sizes can be decisive, and they're decisive for people who have no other information or have no other information they see as better information. That's what we'd hope people would do. We'd hope they would follow the information they take to be the best they have available.
So there's so many different ways to follow up, but we're running out of time. And maybe one last quick question of a substantive nature. What are we responsible for as individuals, epistemically speaking? I mean, if we're rational in outsourcing to others, you know, of course, trusting others, but outsourcing, you know, who we should, you know, rely on, you know, for signaling consensus or, you know, implicitly recommending or whatever, what's left for the individual?
So I'm a responsibility skeptic generally. If by responsibility we mean, I think Zimmerman calls it the hypological sense, that is to do with blame, blame and praise. I'm a skeptic about that sort of responsibility for completely independent reasons. That was another book, Hard Luck, for those who want to rush out and buy it. But of course, we're agents. We're agents who respond to reasons, and we're not product of forces that we can't respond to rationally. And so there's a sense of responsible agency in which we hope to exert or exercise responsible agency. I think, though, a lot of the things we take responsible agency to consist in, responsible epistemic agency to consist in, are not things that I recommend. Things like thinking, well, I don't know whether vaccines are safe and effective. I'm going to go out and do my own research. I don't think that is something that a responsible agent should do. Unless they have a lot of background already, or they're able to acquire it. And acquiring it means very serious work. It doesn't mean going out and reading a couple of popular science books or even a science textbook. It means at least getting degree-level expertise, undergraduate degree-level expertise in that area. That's a minimum, and I don't even know that that's sufficient. Instead, I think what we should be looking for when we're trying to find out for ourselves is looking for evidence about how better to defer. Not everything is rosy in science. Not every consensus is a reliable consensus. Sometimes it reflects bad practices. So, for example, there is work that I relied on in earlier work on agency and self-control, which was massively well replicated and turns out just to be false. Why? Why could this happen? Because something can be well replicated while all the evidence against it's being shelved because it's unpublishable. We know that ego depletion is real. So failures replicated are unpublishable, and you get more and more evidence in favor of an effect that turns out not to be real at all. How do I know that? Well, in this case, the psychological science community got its act together and began to publish failed replications and to conduct pre-registered work and multi-lab work. And we were able to show, or they were able to show, that the effect isn't real. But there were many other results out there that have never been sufficiently replicated. And nothing beats talking to people who are genuinely expert in the field and are sensitive to this kind of concern. In the absence of, you know, tame psychologists on tap, there is work on how fields need to be structured. Are people excluded because they belong to the wrong gender, or Indigenous voices completely excluded on some topics? You know, that's a heuristic that we should be that we should be concerned. Are patient voices being excluded? Is the consensus being accurately reported? I think it's this kind of higher order evidence that we should be looking into, rather than into the first order evidence about, you know, do the drugs work? Is the treatment condition appropriately structured? That sort of thing.
Right. Okay. Well, we could keep this conversation going, but we are out of time. Last question: what are you working on now? Are you, you know, following up this book, or have you gone off in one of your other many different directions?
I am following up in similar sorts of work. AHRC, that's the Arts and Humanities Research Council here in the UK, have funded me to do work in social epistemology on epistemic autonomy, me and Adam Carter at Glasgow. And Templeton have given me money to do some work on rationality in Australia, Macquarie University, with collaborators Mark Alfano and Rob Ross. I am particularly interested right now in non-belief explanations. So, as I mentioned, some people are true believers in these conspiracy theories, but I think there are quite a few who are not true believers. Some of them are just trolls. Some of them are just, out to own the libs or in it for the lulz. But I'm particularly interested in those who I think are sincere but mistaken when they report their beliefs. They take themselves to believe something, but they don't genuinely believe it. That's the current topic of research.
Cool. Okay. Well, I wish you luck with all that very interesting work, and I'm sure we'll be seeing the fruits of those grants and collaborations in short order. But in the meantime, I just wanted to thank you for taking the time to talk with us at New Books in Philosophy about bad belief.
Thanks, Carrie. It's been fun.